All right, today we're going to take a look at evaluating your assets and liabilities and establishing how do I figure out the tax on this. Welcome to the Ultimate Crowdsource Personal Finance Show. This is Choose FI.
You're listening to Choose FI Radio. The blueprint for financial independence lives here. If you're looking to unlock the secrets to financial independence and early retirement, you're in the right place. Stay tuned and join a community of like-minded people who are getting off the hamster wheel and taking control of their lives in the pursuit of financial independence. Choose FI, your home for financial independence online.
Guys, very excited to dive into this week's episode. Again, how do I figure out the taxes on this? We're going to take a look at this concept of assets and figuring out where they fit into a general tax strategy. And then we're going to layer on top of that, potentially looking at, you know, just some ideas around how to access those at the right time. So to help me with this, I have my co-host Brad here with me today. How you doing, buddy?
Hey, Jonathan, I am doing quite well. And yeah, this idea for the episode actually came from my real life this past weekend. So we had Laura's parents in town. My younger daughter, Molly, actually just started swimming year-round again. So she had her first swim meet, which was kind of cool. And yeah, we were just talking and my father-in-law asked me a question, just kind of like a general background question of how do I figure out, okay, I've got all these different buckets, right? As we affectionately call them. I have a 401k, I've got IRAs, I have my regular brokerage account, I have savings. How do I even figure out what gets taxed in what manner? How do I even just think through from a super high level, like Jonathan, like 30,000 foot view of, I know I want to get this amount of money out, right? I want to give gifts or I want to spend it on this or whatever it may be, right? It almost doesn't matter how you fill in the blank, but what the heck am I going to pay taxes on, right? And I think, you know, you and I have been doing this for 5 years. We've been doing Choose FI. I was a CPA before that. And it's kind of second nature to us, but I think I realized very starkly, this is not second nature to just about anybody else. So it's one of those topics that I think we should revisit from time to time. And now seems like as good a day as any, right?
Yeah, this is a phenomenal question. And I think before, you know, we kind of give ourselves credit for being very familiar with it. And in your case, you really are. But I think even for me and for our audience, we're very good about knowing the vehicles that we have access to, the ways, the opportunities, the options that we have to save. And we're pretty good at putting money into those, but that's fundamentally different than then taking money out and knowing what the tax implications of that are, how that's going to affect us in the current year. So for those of us, there's kind of a difference here. And we're going to really focus on individuals that are like, I need all of my money. I need to figure out how to like categorize those somewhere. We'll really focus on that for the second half of the episode. But I think generally to your point, even if you're working or not working, how are these individual buckets that I may or may not have put money into, how are they going to affect my tax liabilities, you know, the following year at tax return season? It's a phenomenal question. And I think it's probably one that a lot of us could use a refresher on.
Yeah. And I think it's obviously also important to say at the outset of the conversation that, you know, of course, everybody's financial situation is different. Everybody's tax situation. There are obviously, it goes without saying, nuances in many, many, many nuances in the U.S. tax code. So we're not giving advice for you specifically. But I think, Jonathan, you and I, we can give a very high level overview of how people should at least mentally approach this. And I think that gets you 95% of the way there. And then, of course, for people in extraordinary circumstances, right? Like somebody who's making a significant amount of money, there are usually phase outs or limitations, right? So like you would know if you're making $500,000-$800,000, like, okay, maybe some of the stuff you and I are talking about today, like you might be subject to phase outs. If you're making virtually no income, right? If you're making $5,000-$10,000, something like that, let's say you just have a part-time job or you're 18 years old, or, you know, like in all likelihood, your tax situation is going to be virtually zero anyway, because you have the standard deduction. So you always have to look at your own situation. But yeah, I think, Jonathan, the best place to start, right, is just as you call them, the buckets, right? Like, how do we think through just like the massive overview of what kind of buckets we've got?
Yes, I am the one to coin the term buckets. I claim all credit for that.
You do love it.
That's not true. That's definitely not true.
Yeah, I guess you obviously didn't come up with it, but you do enjoy that phrase.
I do. And I like to unpack stuff, you know, efficiently.
We still have people that write into us and say, oh, you guys say unpack so often. Like, the great unpacked scandal of 2017, as they like to call it. Like, we probably use that phrase 50 times. And I think we've said it maybe 3 or 4 times in the intervening 4 years.
Yes. The great unpacked scandal of, 2017, man. It was our favorite word that year, for absolutely sure. So, all right, let's repack the unpack and let's talk about buckets. And I think, Brad, you know, it really what we're describing in this case are assets and tax implication of those assets. How would you like to tackle those?
Yeah. So I guess let's start with the different kind of, as we think of them, like retirement savings vehicles. I think that's probably the best place to start. So there are, in very broad terms, because there are lots of specific programs. You hear 401k, 403b, 457, HSA, IRA, Roth IRA, you know, all of these different things, right? But like at its very essence, as I see it, there are two types. There are tax deferred, and there are the other type where you pay the taxes now. Okay, so tax deferred would mean that you get a tax deduction now. So on your ordinary income, so on your tax return, on your 1040, let's say you have wages of $50,000. So that's your ordinary income. It's not any kind of special. We're going to talk later about capital gains and things like that. Those are special tax rates. But how people generally refer to it is your ordinary income. So that's what's based on your normal federal tax brackets. And again, we'll talk about that as well. But let's say you put $10,000 into your 401k. Okay. So in this year, in 2021, you put 10 grand in, you have 50,000 of just regular W-2 income. That 10,000 put into one of these tax deferred vehicles is a tax deduction this year. So you put into your 401k, that's straight off the top. So your 50,000 of income becomes 40 on your tax return. So that means you, in essence, are not paying tax on that income in 2021. So that's why we call it tax deferred, because many, many years down the road, when you take this money out, it then becomes a taxable event. You know, there's no free lunch other than maybe with an HSA, which we'll also talk about. But, you know, for 99% of cases, there's no free lunch. You have to pay tax at some point. It's just a question of, am I going to pay now or am I going to pay later? That's ultimately your question with the Roth versus traditional. That's kind of how we look at this, right? So traditional IRA, traditional 401k, those are, I get that deduction today. Okay. So I'm not paying tax on that income today, but then I do have to pay down the road, versus the Roth type vehicles where I am paying tax. So in that scenario, let's say you put $10,000 into a Roth 401k, right? So your $50,000 of income is there. You're still putting $10,000 into a retirement vehicle, right? But because it's Roth, you're saying, okay, I'm making the choice to get taxed now. And then for the rest of eternity, as long as that money is sitting in there, I am not paying tax on this, right? It grows tax-free, it compounds tax-free. And when you pull it out, it's tax-free as well. So again, you more or less, you're paying tax on one side, on either the front or the back side. So Jonathan, as a non-CPA, does that make sense?
Absolutely. You know, for the purposes of hitting it multiple different ways, let me try to add a few extra words in. I mean, your words are great. Let me add a couple extra. So you're very specifically encouraging people with this first train of thought is to focus on the concept of retirement accounts, right? Like that's what we focused on in this conversation. And when we're saying retirement accounts, what we're thinking about is they're given a preferred tax treatment. There is some aspect of this that's giving you a possible benefit or an edge over what you could do outside of these vehicles if you didn't have it offered. You could talk about this as some form of a tax shelter. Either it's keeping you from not having to pay the tax, you know, now so that you can pay it later, or it's allowing you to pay the tax now so that you don't have to pay it on the growth or when you pull it out later. And Brad, you broke down the actual examples there. And you also rightly pointed out that, all right, tax deferred, that's your 401k or your 403b. And there's several variants of that, depending on whether you're working for, you know, a public body, et cetera. And then on the other side, which is the Roth instrument. And okay, so to be clear, there's your 401k, there's your 403b, there's your traditional IRA, right? That's another one that they might slip through there. And then on the Roth side, now we have a Roth IRA and we have a Roth 401k. These are preferred tax vehicles. They're given special treatment inside of our IRS tax code. If you choose to take on the benefits, you're not going to get away without paying any taxes, but it's just kind of when do you want it to hit? And there might be advantages based on your marginal tax bracket now versus your marginal tax bracket later, what you expect it to be, that would make you prefer one or the other.
Yeah, and that is a brilliant point. And that's actually ultimately what it comes down to. In a large sense, it's a bet, right? So you are betting against current versus future tax rates. And lots of us can prognosticate over what those tax rates are going to be, but ultimately we have no idea, right? We can all make cases, and I'm sure all of us in our brains are making our own cases right now as we're listening to these words, but you in essence have no idea, which is why, like, you know, my frame on this is just simply, I have no idea, but what can I control? I can control my tax rate now. So that's why if I were making a case for my own life, and again, personal finance is personal. Jonathan, you and I don't give advice here. We just kind of talk through it, how we think about it in our own lives. Like for me, I think clearly if I was in a federal tax bracket, like a tiny one, obviously if I was paying no federal tax or if I was paying 10% tax, that might skew my answer because a current deduction, right, in a 401k or traditional IRA is not really going to be much value. But I think for most people who are making, you know, a middle-class income that are in, let's say, a 22%+ tax bracket, for me, it's, okay, I can control my tax right now by getting a tax deduction today. So I think that's why my own bias would lean me towards a tax-deferred vehicle. Because again, I have no idea what tax rates are going to be in the future, but I know what they are now, right? And that's one thing I can look at. How do you think through that for your own self?
Well, yeah, I think I agree with your point around, you know, it's a bet, but I think many of us, our bias would be to bet on ourselves. Like, well, I bet I'm going to make more later than I make now. Like I'm going to do whatever I got to do over the intervening period of years to make sure I'm making more later. And the natural conclusion that you would come to if you're betting on that result, which why are we here? We're trying to learn more information. We're trying to find ways to earn more. Right, would be to then say, well, okay, so I should lock in my lower tax rate now because, you know, 10 years from now, I'm going to 10X, right? So lock in the relatively lower tax rate now. That way I don't have to pay it later. So that would kind of steer you towards Roth. And the slight cautionary point that you would make there is actually the point you made. It's not so much like, you know, if you end up going through that same decision tree and then still, I think I'm going to 10X and I'm still interested in in a pre-tax 401k, it's because I'm going to control what I can control right now, and I'm going to look for the options that are available to me at that particular point in time to make the most optimal decision. And I think I'll have more flexibility. Like, for instance, what if you start moving, you know, a lot of your income to a type of income that you can control, how it actually hits your bank account? The wealthy, the extremely wealthy, have an unbelievable ability to control their tax rate. In fact, Warren Buffett, I believe, made this comment probably just to the Berkshire community at large, but it was basically a comparison between him and his secretary. And Warren Buffett in this scenario, was basically saying, my secretary as a percentage pays a higher percentage in tax than I do. And I think he was, you know, bemoaning in that case, maybe that it was unfair, but you know, as a wealthy individual, he's going to literally employ a team of accountants to make sure that that can still happen for him, right? You're going to use the tax code. So that's an individual that clearly, you know, has 10X'd, but at the same time, you know, control his tax rate at a particular point to give him the chance to control his tax rate in the most optimal way for him later, you know, wherever he might find himself. That's kind of the case. Even if you're I believe I'm going to 10X, that doesn't necessarily mean you should just automatically choose to pay the tax now.
Yeah, that's a really good point, especially when we're talking about people in the financial independence community, right? Because if you eventually get to a point where, okay, you have a significant amount of assets, right? You might have millions and millions of dollars in assets, but if you get to a point where you eventually stop working in whatever manner that looks like for you and you're earning no income, right? Then you have the ultimate flexibility of determining, what do I pull out of these accounts? What do I actually trigger purposefully, right? Not from a reactionary standpoint, but purposefully, what am I pulling out to trigger a taxable event? I'm controlling precisely what tax bracket I'm in precisely what tax I'm paying based on the rules as I see them that year. So there's a very, very strong mental case to be made for, okay, I'm in the FI community. This is how I want to approach it. So anyway, that's all kind of fodder for just how people think about it. But I think one really, really critical point when we're talking about these type of accounts, Jonathan. So basically, we think about, like, I use this ridiculous term, like the umbrella. So a 401k in and of itself, it's nothing. It's just a bucket. It's an umbrella. It's just this category, basically. But what you buy in there, okay, those are the assets that you're buying in there that are hopefully going to grow and compound over years and decades.
Right. So if you have it in a 401k, but it's literally sitting in cash.
Yeah.
Okay, you are in a 401k, but there will be no compounding or very minimal compounding.
Right, exactly. Or people, like, you know, many people don't even understand. Like, they think, oh, I'm investing in my 401k, as if that in and of itself is something. No, it's you are contributing money to your 401k. And then within that 401k, there are different assets that you can purchase to, like you said, compound. So let's just say very simply, we're going to do this at the super high level. You are buying some type of mutual fund. It doesn't matter. We're not going to get into our normal scenario of low-cost index funds and all that stuff. Jonathan, that's, you know, a separate conversation, right? We're just talking about tax treatment. So in these type of buckets, and this contrasts very specifically with what we're going to talk about afterwards with your regular investing accounts. This is outside of retirement vehicles, right? When you're just talking about, hey, I've got money left over, I'm going to invest in stocks, right? Or I'm going to invest in mutual funds more specifically. You need to keep track very, very specifically of, hey, what did I buy that mutual fund for, right? What was the cost of that fund or that stock or whatever it was? Because that number matters. That number is your basis, and it's ultimately going to inform the capital gains tax that you pay when you sell that particular security or index fund or whatever. So that's a separate case. But what we're talking about here with these retirement vehicles is while you are investing in things like that, the basis really does not matter. I mean, there might be some isolated instance, there might be some accountant yelling at me right now, but for 99% of cases that I can think of, the basis does not matter. It's just, again, is it a Roth, in which case I paid the tax up front, and then no matter what I buy in there, no matter how much it went up or down, it doesn't matter, okay, for tax purposes. So this Roth, let's say you put 10 grand in 2021 and you invested, and over the next 50 years, it grew to $1 million, you know, just totally making it up. It doesn't matter what that capital gain was. In that case, $990,000 is how much that went up. That's irrelevant. What matters is what you're pulling out, right? But because it's a Roth, Jonathan, you pay the tax up front. And on the backside, when you pull out, no matter what you pull out, right? You pull out $1 or $1 million, you're paying $0 in tax on it. So the capital gain doesn't matter. You don't have to calculate it at all. It's not a factor. It's just simply, okay, I paid the tax up front, I don't have to pay it on the backside.
And tying this to, I think, some numbers is really important for people. So when you make the choice to fund a 401k or a Roth IRA, pre-tax or post-tax, with that decision, it's not talking about your whole income. It's just talking about what you actually invest to that tax preferred vehicle. So as an example, when Brad was talking earlier about this individual, maybe they're just in a 10%, you know, marginal tax bracket. Maybe this individual is trying to make the decision, should I put that in my 401k or should I contribute that to my Roth IRA? And for this individual, let's say they were going to contribute $2,000 or $5,000. We'll just go $2,000 for this example. Yeah, $2,000. Let's use $2,000. If they were going to contribute $2,000 and they're in a 10% marginal tax bracket, it's going to cost them $200 in taxes to put that into the Roth IRA. It's not that bad. But what that means is that's never going to be counted toward their income again. So if, let's say this young individual has 40 years of growth and it's doubling every 8 years or so. And it's, you know, it's 2, then 4, then 8, then 16, 32. You know, at some point, maybe you have 50 grand. That 50 grand, whenever you pull it, you've already paid all the taxes on that. All the taxes have already been paid. You could pull it out all at once if you wanted to. No tax implications. You could let it ride, leave it for your heirs, let it turn into 100, 200, you know, that sort of thing. Versus that same individual saying, all right, well, I'm only paying a 10% tax on this. but I don't want to pay that $200. So I'm going to put that in my 401k and I'll just, you know, let's say it turns into 50K down the road. I'll be willing to pay. At that point, you're like, really? Like, is it worth it for you to defer that? Now, before, this was a very normal example. And you could see maybe how if they're in, you know, a 25% marginal tax bracket, or it's now we're talking about someone that's got, you know, their marginal tax bracket plus their state tax, which kind of puts them closer to 30, you know, and so they're contributing $5,000 or $10,000. Now we're saying you're gonna have to pay an extra $3,000 in tax to put that $10,000 towards, you know, or that $5,000, you know, there are a lot of numbers getting fudged here, but you get it. You're talking about a multiple $1,000 tax bill. What do you think? And now you're trying to weigh the pros and cons. And I just want to give you real quick an extreme example of understanding that this making that bet. Peter Thiel. Is it Thiel or Thiel, Brad?
I think it's Thiel.
Thiel. Let's go with Thiel. All right. Peter Thiel made the choice to put $2,000 into his Roth IRA back in 1999. That $2,000 is now worth $5 billion, Brad. With a B. He has $5 billion in a Roth IRA. I mean, he broke the game so much that they're probably going to change the tax laws at some point. They were so, you know, frustrated at seeing this result. And to be honest, we couldn't do that. He was able to take advantage of a stock deal unavailable to most people and pre-fund it via some. I'm not saying this is replicable for people, but I am saying this is an extreme example of how powerful this treatment is. Because he paid maybe $200 in tax in 1999 to get that $2,000 into that Roth IRA, and it's now $5 billion, he's going to access $5 billion completely tax-free. And based on current tax law, there is nothing anyone can do about it, right? I don't care how you feel about it. It's his tax-free. He wants to take it all at once. He wants to let it ride. He wants to do something else. He never has to pay taxes on, and how many other billionaires, you know, are going to be able to use that exact same vehicle? Like, that's beyond, you know, mind exploding, right?
Yeah, I certainly remembered hearing about that in the last couple of weeks. And it sounded, as you said, it's not replicable, but it is illustrative of the benefits of a Roth type account, right? So, you know, we've talked through that. And now I guess let's go back to the tax treatment of traditional accounts, right? So a traditional IRA or 401k, et cetera. So as we said, you get a tax deduction on the front side, right? So you've never paid tax on that income. So you had your regular income, you got the deduction. So there was no tax paid. It was just this money that in our hypothetical, our $10,000 was just put into this 401k account. So never been taxed. That's what we call tax deferred. And again, you invest it and it doesn't matter what you purchase in there. It doesn't matter what the underlying basis is. It doesn't matter if individual stocks have gone up or down. You don't need to track that, because what does matter is the money that you pull out of the account. Okay, so that is the taxable event when you decide to pull that money out of your 401k. And Jonathan, for the sake of argument, for the sake of this example, we'll just say this is just a traditional retiree, you know, 59 and a half or later, you decide to pull some money out. Again, and we will talk about this immediately after, which is in your regular brokerage accounts, if you were in that scenario, you would be looking at all that information, right? Like, hey, when did I buy this specific stock or mutual fund? How much did I buy it for? What is this exact one worth now? Because that's how you determine what the gain is that you'll pay tax on, right? As opposed to just the sale price. So if you bought something for $99 and you sold it for $100, you're not paying tax on the $100 of proceeds. You're only paying tax on the difference, right? The proceeds minus the basis. So in that case, you'd only be paying tax on $1. That's no big deal. But contrast that with, like we're talking about here, these traditional retirement accounts, these tax-deferred retirement accounts, you are paying tax on the full amount that you pull out. Because again, that money wasn't taxed up front, so it's taxed on the backside, right? So let's say, again, that $10,000 over many, many decades grew to $1 million. And then in that next year, you decide to pull out $1 million, all of it, right? You pay tax on every single one of those dollars. Now, obviously, I wouldn't advocate doing that. I think more normally, somebody would pull out, hey, what do I need to live this year, right? So maybe it's $50,000. Okay, so you pull out $50,000. Again, it doesn't matter what it's in. It could be sitting there in cash. It could be sitting in a mutual fund that you bought 60 years before for a tiny little fraction. It's irrelevant. It's just, how much do I pull out? That goes on your tax return as ordinary income. And that's what you're taxed on, right? So you obviously get your normal deductions. you know, who knows what the tax code will look like 60 years from now. So I'm not going to say a standard deduction that might not exist, but, you know, that exists in 2021. So, you know, that's kind of how you think about this, is all of that is taxable. So, yeah, I mean, from a real high level, Jonathan, I think that that pretty much covers like the main distinction between how people should approach those buckets.
And Brad, to your point, when you're talking about the 401k, the reason that it's going to be so effective for so many people is to save the amount of money that you needed to save. You needed to be in a higher marginal tax bracket, right? To create that space. By virtue of you going out and crushing it and earning more, you're pushing it into this 22% marginal tax rate and beyond for many of you. So these are your high, your peak income earning years. And by making the choice to pay the taxes later, you're deferring it for a day when likely you're not working. Many of you pursuing financial independence have the goal at some point of leaving your corporate job, leaving your job at some particular point in time. And in that case, you're not working. And now you have money, you're drawing it down, but you're deciding how much. And so based on 2021 income, your first, for a married couple filing joint, it was around your first $24,000, Brad, was tax-free. For single, it was $12,000. You could adjust accordingly. So Millionaire Educator has a free money article that he publishes each year. And for him, it's him and his wife. They're on the path to financial independence. They do have one child. So this is a child tax credit here as well, which is going to complicate and make their numbers. It's going to inflate their numbers a little bit. The child tax credit is a dollar for dollar reduction of your tax bill by about $2,000. But I think there are a lot of people in this audience that can identify with married filing joint, one child tax credit. And just for example, because they really lean on the power of this free money concept, leveraging the standard deduction. And Brad, I know I fudged that number a little bit, so maybe you can tighten it up for people that are really wanting to lock in on that. But between that free money concept and a child tax credit, the way they basically look at, you know, what their tax bill is going to be is they can have a tax bill of $0 if they were to decide to live. And again, you decide, right? This isn't how much you can pay. It's how much you want to draw down of your assets in this pre-tax 401k. If they want to live on $45,000, they're going to have a tax bill wiped out of zero. And that zero is being netted because of the child tax credit in their case. So you could add $2,000 onto that in the absence of that, maybe. If they want to have a tax bill of $1,000, they can live off of $52,000 a year. They can draw $52,000 and only pay $1,000 in tax. Again, add the child tax credit back, right? In the scenario where you don't have that child present. For a tax bill of $2,000, they can draw up to $60,000. And for a tax bill of $3,000, $67,000. Just to show you how powerful the idea is of you controlling your tax rate. And I know a lot of people that, you know, having paid off their mortgage, going or near paid off their mortgage, you know, kids are out, college is paid for, et cetera, are going to live very comfortably on $70,000, you know, right around that number. So just to show you how for, you know, us everyday people that are just, you know, saving a percentage of our income over time, by being able to control this tax rate, we're going to have a lot of flexibility with how much tax we actually pay.
Yeah, I think this is why we say financial independence is truly the ultimate life hack, right? We get to control things that normal people sit and moan about, right? Oh, I pay too much in taxes. Oh, this and that. Like, okay, you know, I get that from a certain perspective, but you can actually take control of this, right? Like you just described, Jonathan, a perfect way that someone in the FI community can take control of this, which is, okay, I'm getting a tax deduction in a current year, and then I control how much money I pull out down the road because I control what my expenses are. I mean, that's a pretty fantastic way to look at life, right? You don't have to moan about it anymore. You have control over it. And I mean, what you just painted a picture of a very prototypical, stereotypical FI life is over years and decades, I paid off my mortgage. My expenses don't even have to be that low. Like you just said, I mean, if you have your cars paid off, your house paid off, and you're spending 70 grand a year, you're living reasonably well, quite well is what I would
quite
say.
Well.
But, right? And you're paying a tiny little pittance in tax. So anyway, we don't want to belabor the point here, obviously, because we're, you know, generally talking about taxes. But like the cool thing is this narrative of FI and how much control you have over your life, it's there. It's there always. And I don't want people to forget this. Like that level of control that you have over your life, it cannot be overstated. So yeah, Jonathan, I'm glad you brought that up.
Hey, this is Andrew from the Choose FI team. I hope you're enjoying the show. We're going to get right back to it after these quick messages.
So So you had your retirement accounts, which we just kind of did a deep dive, really exploring that pre-tax versus post-tax, you know, and just as this little summary here, for the case of Millionaire Educator, I'm sure they're making a lot more now than they were as that teenager trying to decide whether or not to fund their Roth, et cetera. But because of their tax planning with their, you know, taking advantage of these pre-tax vehicles and understanding the tax code, their effective tax rate, and it includes that child tax credit in this case, but their effective tax rate is 4.28% on a $70,000 income, Brad. $70,000 income, 4.28%. That's an incredible understanding of the tax code and why, you know, these marginal tax rates are all bets, but ultimately it's your effective tax rate that's going to determine, you know, how much you pay at the end of the day. So that's all on the retirement side. And really the focus was, because it's all going to end up becoming income, right? It's all going to end up becoming either income now or income later. How will that affect our effective tax rate for this optimal scenario? That's what's just happened there, but it's income. Now what we're moving to is after-tax savings and investments, which is treated differently because you already paid tax on it as income. You pay tax on income and then you made the choice to do something with it. Now something's going to happen. Hopefully it's going to go up. Maybe it goes down. Maybe it goes up and down and up. But that's now different. That's fundamentally different than taking a look at how these other vehicles were affecting your income tax bracket.
Yeah, that is the perfect setup. And I think really that's the way we should all think about this money, right? So this is the money that's left over, right? We still have never, nobody's ever come up with a convincing phrase to use to describe this. We call it taxable investing, but I got to be honest, that's a terrible phrase and it's super confusing. But, you know, for the sake of argument, that's what most people call it. So you will hear that. But I mean, Jonathan, this is just your regular savings. So you have your income, you have hopefully the money that you put away into some type of retirement vehicle that we just spent the last 20 odd minutes talking about. You have all your expenses, you have your taxes, right? And then you've got money left over. You have your savings, okay? Now, again, people call this taxable investing, which is terrible, but it's just your savings. That money has to go somewhere. It can go under your mattress, it can go in your freezer, it can go in a bank, it can go into real estate, it can go into a brokerage account where you can invest in stocks or mutual funds, right? Among many places, right? There's an exhaustive list, but you know, that kind of gives a frame, right? This is the money you've got left over from savings, okay? And Jonathan, as you so aptly described, you have been taxed on that money, right? But when it was your income, right? In the year that you earned it, you were taxed because as we've gone through multiple times, you've got your income, you've got the money that you shuttle aside into tax-deferred vehicles, you've got your deductions on your tax return, and then you have your taxable income, which is what's left, and you pay tax on that, right? That's how our normal taxation works, okay? So this is, again, this is the money that's sitting there left over, right? After you then took that money and spent it on whatever you normally spend in life. You have your savings. So this money's been taxed. It's now yours to do with. So if you put it in a bank and it earned interest, that interest is income. Now, I wouldn't advocate that necessarily. You're not going to get rich on the 0.01% of interest income you're getting in most banks. But
there was a time not so long ago where it felt like a decent proposition for money. Like, you know, you make 2%. It sounds good.
Yeah, 2-3%. We used to say on online banks, I think dating myself from when I graduated college, I think it was like 5%, like ING Direct. It was the first online bank. And I mean, that felt pretty fantastic. But yeah, I mean, right now, and it could always switch, but right now, it does not seem like the greatest idea to put it in a bank of any types. But regardless, you know, that gives you a sense that you're not paying. So let's say you put $20,000 into that bank, right? That's the money you've already paid tax on. You're not paying tax on that. In subsequent years, you're paying tax on the income you earn on that. So if you get 1% on $20,000, it's $200. $200 will be interest income that you put on your tax return. Okay. So it's basically, we got to always think, and this is why I'm drilling down into this, it's the income that you earn. So now let's contrast that with, okay, we decided to invest this in mutual funds. So you've got that 20 grand. And you decide to put it all into a mutual fund or an ETF, like a total stock market index fund. So you have put $20,000 in and you have purchased X number of shares of this mutual fund. Okay. What will happen is the brokerage will keep track of what you purchased that for. So that's known as your basis. You bought them at $100 a share, and that is your basis in that share, we'll say ETFs, right? So these are broad-based index funds, basically, but they're the ETF version. So $100 a share. Now, let's say it stays there forever. It doesn't grow for 50 years. Hopefully you would have been smart enough to find a different investment, but let's say you weren't and you've got $20,000 at $100 a share down the road, you sell all of it. What's your tax on that? Your tax is zero because you have $0 of gains, right? You bought it for 100, you sold it for 100. It doesn't matter that you got $20,000. That's known as the proceeds. The proceeds don't matter. It's just the gain. Okay. So selling price minus the purchase price, the basis, basically. And again, accountants out there are yelling at me because there are slight things, you know, dividends will impact. There are some fees that will impact that kind of stuff. But we're not talking about this, right? Like we're talking conceptual so people can understand. Again, not financial advice for your situation. This is a concept and it's important that we all understand it. So in that scenario, you're paying nothing in tax. But Jonathan, that's not likely to happen, right? Over 50 years. What's more likely to happen is it's going to, I don't know, 10x, right? So let's say it goes from that $20,000 to $200,000. And this again is assuming in this bizarre example, assuming that you just bought that one time and you decide now to sell them all at that 50-year point. So you sell everything. It's worth, the fair market value is worth $200,000. So you get $200,000 into your bank account, right? That's the proceeds. And okay, it's tax time. I've got to figure out, hey, what do I owe? So you take the proceeds minus your original purchase price. Because again, you've already paid tax on that, right? That's your basis and your purchase price. So in this scenario, your taxable gain, your capital gain would be $180,000. So it'd be the $200,000 you sold everything for minus the 20 grand that you bought it for is 180. And that's the capital gain. This, in this case, this would be a long-term capital gain, which means it's 1 year or more. Okay. And based on current tax law, there's a favorable tax treatment for long-term capital gains. So the tax rates are significantly lower. So that 1 year point, this is important for people to remember, is their short-term, which is ordinary income rates, right? That's your regular tax bracket, like we talked about before, 22%, 24, 32, those are huge. As opposed to the long-term, if you sell it after a year, in most cases, again, except for people with extraordinary income on either the low or high side, it's 15% for federal right now. That's why that long and short-term is important to remember. So that's kind of a framework. And I will go through another example in a minute here of what's more realistic of somebody buying over many years. But just for this simplistic version, you know, in that case, that person has $180,000 capital gain, which goes on their tax return. It would be taxed at 15%, right? And they'd pay $27,000 in tax on it, walk away. That's the deal. So that hopefully made sense from like a real, real high level.
Yeah. And I was trying to, you know, I was doing some math as you were saying that. I think what I really want to draw people's attention to is how you had to caveat a couple things when we were talking about this component. We had to explore these terms, basis versus capital gain. And then you also need to add into that, you know, the next layer, which is, did you hold it for more than a year or less than a year, which slightly, you know, nuances how, what the tax treatment is. But just really understand that line of delineation. We did not have to really think about it, that at all. When we were talking about the retirement vehicles, didn't come in place. Everything is income. It's just, is it income that was already taxed or income that's going to be taxed? That was it. It was that simple. And then, you know, we're taking a look at this bet on marginal tax brackets and thinking, what will our effective tax rate be? But now we're adding an extra layer of complexity here. We are tracking this. And to track it, if you're using a reputable brokerage, it's not going to be that difficult. They're going to send you a report at the end of the year. But even the method of that tracking, there's some nuance there. Like there's options on how you report that basis, like whether it's what they call the average basis. So all your shares aggregated together, versus like first in versus first out. So you're, you know, the ones that were bought the oldest, the longest time ago have obviously had the biggest gain over the others. You know, you have some options there. And I think you can make a new choice every single year, but I think you have to be probably consistent with, you know, what choice you actually make. So you can't do like a blend of this and a blend of that. It's kind of like, do you want to do first in, first out, or do you want to do average base? So you don't need to think about that a whole lot right now, but I just wanted to very much point out the difference between what Brad was saying, between the retirement and then now in this taxable investments, your savings, what are you doing with your money? We need to now say, we're not just talking about income, was it taxed or not, but we're actually saying, What was my basis? How much gain do I have? And is that going to be short-term capital gains or long-term capital gains? Because that's going to add to, you know, when we get to maybe this next part, we're going to spend a few minutes talking about how to pull all this together into a drawdown, not your drawdown strategy, but rather a conversation around how you might approach it. What would be the points of consideration? These are things, these are the variables that affected, you know, how I personally thought through mine and probably what the decision tree that I'll go through when I'm actually accessing the money.
Yeah. And you brought up a really good point with how to identify what you're selling, right? And you said most brokerages, and this will be much more applicable in this example that, the quick example I'm going to go through now, which is a more realistic life of, hey, I've been investing every single year, right? I'm in the FI community. I have a savings rate, right? That's the whole point. You're not going to get wealthy unless you have savings and you can continually invest this over years and decades. It doesn't work that way, right? So you're presumably, again, let's go under this working assumption. This person is investing in index funds, right? They're buying ETFs and they're doing this every single year, right? Every single month, every single week, whatever it is, every paycheck that they have money left over, they're continually investing. Now, obviously, this is not this simplistic example, Jonathan, that I gave before, which is, hey, I bought everything for $100 a share and it grew for 60, 70 years and that was that. This is simple, right? This is, hey, I'm buying shares all over the place in terms of price, right? Because that's kind of the whole point. We talk about dollar cost averaging, right? Like if the stock market's down, if it crashed 50% the day before, you're getting things on sale and you're buying more shares with those same dollars, right? Or if the stock market's up, you get slightly fewer shares. So you need to keep track of that. And that would be extraordinarily laborious to do this personally, right? And that's why we have computers. That's why we have brokerages that we, in essence, in the background, pay to do this for us. So I know I have accounts at Vanguard, for instance, and one of the options that they have is, like you said, there's like some average cost method. I think there's first in, first out. And there's also specific ID, which is the one that I choose, which to me is kind of a no-brainer because, again, I want to control. I want to control what I sell specifically because I'm not just a regular person off the street. I'm in the FI community and I understand the rules. So I want to be able to, in some cases, trigger additional taxable events, which most people don't want to, right, Jonathan?
Well, it's because we're going to bring all this together and we're not going to do a deep dive on this. We've done it in the past. We've done episodes around it. But there's actually, when you're talking about now long-term capital gains, which is what you would be triggering most likely, something you held more than a year, you're picking a lot you've held for more than a year or an ID for more that you held for a year. We're looking at these different points at which that tax rate could potentially change, which is why it should be part of our plan. It's not a reflexive action. It's more like, we're mapping out what we want to do for a year. We understand the buckets. And Brad, that tees us up. I'd love to just share with you before we started the episode, I wrote down just, I think how I would tackle this. It's not the universal answer and people have different conditions, but it's just kind of based on the building blocks that we've laid out, kind of how I would go about tackling said money, assuming that, you know, I had the luxury of all of these options. This is probably what I would do. And I'm kind of setting myself up here for criticism because I know it's not the ultimate answer. And I want people to hear that this is not the ultimate answer. It's just based on the rules that we laid out, this would make sense to me right now with the ability to revise again, based on the rules in your actual setting, you know, your actual income at a point in time.
So this is you in FI, or give me an example of like, what's the point in time we're talking about here?
Great point, right? So we have all these rules about when we can act. So this is, we didn't add this on. There's rules about when you can access the benefits of those retirement accounts. Like there was a trade-off for that tax-preferred treatment. They're incentivizing you to save for retirement. Now, in past episodes, we've talked about a few ways to circumnavigate that and to access that money earlier without incurring penalties. But the reason that most people think of the traditional retirement age as 59 and a half is because if you were to access money that you put in these retirement vehicles prior to that, you are going to incur a 10% penalty off the top. And then on top of that, the income rate that would apply to you at a point in time. So we could do this. We could talk about it at any age. You just have to add the 10% for the purposes of this. And again, we're talking about your father-in-law, going back to the beginning of the example. Why don't we just assume the 59 and a half is behind us? We're 59 and a half, or we've jumped through some hoops and we've accessed the rule of 55. People can check that out in a search, but there are, you know, some additional caveats that you could look into. But let's just say we're 59 and a half or beyond, and we're taking a look at all of our buckets, and man, we have a bunch of them. And we're trying to say what would make sense for us. If I were doing this analysis, what I'm going to start with is free money. And I'm referring to the Millionaire Educator episode, but I just quickly did some math and I'm assuming a couple married filing joint in this example, no kids. I went ahead and said, I made a quick adjustment here for no kids. All right. So empty nesters. And just as two quick rule of thumbs here in 2021, what I came up with is if you were to be living on pre-tax money, we're not capped there, but let's just say start there. For our pre-tax money, if we were to pull about $45,000, that would be a federal tax bill of $2,000 on pre-tax money, right? So you're drawing out your 401k, $2,000 tax bill that puts us at an effective tax rate of 4.3%. Not bad, right? You hear that? Not bad. And because we're not going to stop here, but I just wanted to give you a range. We could draw up to $70,000 using current tax law here in 2021, if this were the year that you were doing it. And your tax bill would be $5,000, which would be an effective tax rate of 7.13%. So that's your range, $45,000 all the way up to $70,000. And that puts you an effective tax rate between 4 and 7%. Not bad as a place to start. So we're starting with that. That accounts for our standard deduction. And, you know, that is just kind of the first threshold. We'll take a look at how much income do we want, right? Let's start there.
And Jonathan, just to interject real quick. So you're painting a picture again of you have life expenses to cover. That's what you're talking about here. You have no income. You have money littered across a bunch of different accounts, presumably. You have traditional IRAs and 401ks. You have some Roth vehicles.
Yes.
You obviously have regular, as we call it ridiculously, taxable savings, right? And you might have an HSA. You might have all these different things. So you're trying to say, okay, I've got no income. I've got to cover my expenses. What do I do?
Right, exactly. So the one that I'm looking at to draw that first, you know, depending on what you came up with, that first $45,000 all the way up to $70,000, I'm looking at my 401k. If I had a traditional IRA, that might be one that I would look at if I just wanted to clean it up and get it out of there, if I had some stuff in there. If I had a 403b or I had a 457, these are all ones that generally would fall into this category. So my first baseline income is coming from those pre-tax vehicles. Now, from there, I'm actually going to pivot into the second half of our conversation. And I want to actually, at that point, I think, and you could make the case, you could either look at your taxable savings and investments, or at this point, you could start looking at your Roth vehicles, or you could start thinking about your HSA, you know, which is kind of has some hybrid. We didn't really talk about it a whole lot today, but has some, you know, hybrid characteristics to it. I actually probably, in the absence of, you know, mapping out an individual's exact game plan, my bias at that point might be to let the Roth and the HSA go as long as possible. Because again, all gains on the Roth are going to be tax-free. You've already paid the tax on it. And the HSA is tax-free if, again, unique characteristics HSA outside this conversation, if you have medical bills. And who tends to get medical bills at a faster rate? People at the over the age of 59 and a half. So like you're kind of creating a self-funding healthcare fund. So I tend to like, let's let as much gain happen there as possible because you're going to have more power the longer we can hold this off. And so in the difference of whatever I need to make up, and again, remember on the pre-tax, we decided to get somewhere between $45,000 and $70,000. Now we're saying, well, how much do we want for our annual expenses? There's some gap. Maybe they need an extra $20,000. Maybe they need an extra $40,000, et cetera. The thing is now, what are those thresholds for long-term capital gain? So I'm looking at my after-tax investment vehicles. I'm looking at what's in my brokerage accounts, not in my retirement accounts, not getting any preferred tax treatment. They're just in my regular investment accounts. And I'm really looking at those capital gain thresholds. And Brad, I'll hand this back to you because let's say that I decided, you know, I'm 70, I'm drawing $45,000 out of my pre-tax 401k, but my life cost, you know, $70,000. That's what I need. So that means that I'm going to draw the remainder out. And so I need another $30,000. I'm going to draw that out from, again, these investments, not tax preferred, not any sort of treatment, just my investments. But there's some nuance here, Brad, because like you need to know what is the capital gains rate for an individual there, which is, Brad, under a certain threshold, it's like it's 0%. I'll give you this back to you to clarify. But what are the thresholds for the long-term capital gains rates? And then because I only need some dollar amount, I don't really care for my life, whether it's basis or whether it's gain. Like all I need is a total 30. Now that gives me some flexibility again with what specific lot IDs I'm picking.
Yeah, you're right. There's a lot of flexibility here, you know, based on 2021 rules. Like you said, I'm looking at the 2021 capital gains tax rates for married filing joint. And it's showing, interestingly enough, if your income is below $80,800, your long-term capital gains tax is actually zero, Jonathan, which is amazing. So this person who, if you said their income or their expenses are 70 or 75,000, all right, now we're in a scenario where, like you said, they took about 45 out and are paying just $1,000 or under $2,000 in federal tax. And since they're well under this threshold, they can incur, in this case, another $35,000 of capital gains, right? Yeah. Again, that's not proceeds. That's capital gains. So that is the difference between the basis and the selling price. So we're not talking about, hey, you bought it for zero and you sold it for 35. That's all capital gains. In most cases, to pull out a capital gains of 35, you might get 70,000 or multiples of that, depending on how many decades in the past you bought it. So you might be in a scenario where you have pulled out all of this money in terms of proceeds and essentially paid $0 in capital gains tax on it, which is remarkable. And now, Jonathan, again, this is why being flexible is so important, because in that scenario, okay, this person might have pulled out the next 3 years worth of expenses at $0 in tax on those capital gains, right? They might have that money now that, okay, I've sold it. Now I could rebuy additional if I wanted to reinvest it, or just put it in a bank account if I wanted to be ultra, ultra safe, since it's over the next year or two that I'm going to use this as expenses. You've got options. But in essence, you have just permanently avoided that tax on this because you know the rules. That is a permanent 0% tax on that, which is miraculous, right? But it's not miraculous. It's just the rules.
Right. I mean, you've described a scenario where someone is very plausibly bringing in $100,000 a year and paying an effective tax rate of 4%. That's what just got described. That's just the rule. And so that person,
that Jonathan, right?
It could be far more.
It could be a lot better on both sides.
Well, and then to your point, and now we're talking about capital gains harvesting, and this is a conversation that we'll do a refresher on. But now you're right. The person that's like, well, I could bring out another, because it's just basis, I could bring out another 20, 30, or 40 and still be at that 0% tax rate. Should I? Because I don't need the money right now. And many people would make the case, yes, you should, because you're going to be resetting your basis for that amount and you're going to push that forward. And so when you do need this money down the road, it's going to make it easier for you to access without incurring any actual long-term capital gains that you need to pay the government. Like, it's just, you know, you're paying it, but the rate you're paying it at is at 0% because you reset basically outside this conversation. But I'm just showing you why having a plan and understanding your framework for accessing it, it can make tens of thousands of dollars of difference in just a single year on your tax bill, as opposed to not having a plan and just axing it, you know, willy-nilly. So, okay, willy-nilly. I cracked myself. All right.
Pulled that out of nowhere.
Yeah, yep. All right, so we just talked about these two. I hope people appreciate those two work so well together for people that are living, you know, lifestyles not in debt up to your eyeballs, right? People that are living, that have made these purchases over time, they understand and they're controlling what their life actually costs. They are just crushing it and they're thriving in this tax code. Now we're layering onto this the next layers. If for some reason the 401k and the after-tax didn't get us there, now, in my opinion, is the right time we can buffer to some varying degree with either the HSA or the Roth. And the HSA, you know, once you're over the age of 59 and a half, because the money went in pre-tax, it is now taxable as income unless you're using it for a qualified medical expense. So as long as you're tracking your receipts, and I mean, it's very conceivable to see how you track what you've been paying over years, maybe with whatever you paid, you've been using that to advance your travel rewards shenanigans. You track those receipts though, and then now you have potentially, you know, thousands of dollars a year that you could access. It went in pre-tax, grew tax-free, you're drawing it out tax-free because it's a qualified medical expense. But if that's not the case, or if you want to let that sit down the road because you are likely to have more, you know, expenses as you get older, then let's just look at the Roth at this point. We already paid the taxes on the Roth. If we need an extra $5,000, we need an extra $10,000, and we're already coming outside of the 0% tax bracket, you could make the case, once you get past zero on long-term capital gains with the after-tax income, you just go to 15%. So like your income tax rate, and keep in mind, you know, you had your 10 and your 12%, and then on the other side, you had 22%. The capital gains limit, the long-term capital gains tax rate is 15%. And it's for people with a, you know, married, filing joint income up to $400,000. So your basis can carry you from whatever space you had, you know, at the 0% all the way up to the very end of that $400,000. That's a lot of room. That's a lot of room to work even inside a 15% framework. you don't need to have that perfectly dialed in. I think if you really understand the interplay between 401k and your after-tax investments, your capital gains, how those two overlap, you're going to crush the game. And then it's just a game at the margins of when you want to, you know, solidify your position with your Roth, maybe add extra cushion, or do you want to maybe make the Roth vehicle what you leave for your heirs? That's what a lot of people end up doing because they don't end up needing it after they've got those other two ones, you know, totally dominated.
Yeah, I think that's a great way to summarize, Jonathan. I think, yeah, hopefully this made a lot of sense for everybody. Gave, you know, that framework, like you said, there are details at the margins. That's beyond the scope of one podcast talking to many, many tens upon tens of thousands of people. That's not what we're doing here. We're not giving you precise advice, but man, this framework should allow you to move forward and say, all right, I control this. And I understand from a real high level how all of this stuff is taxed and the interplay, right? The interplay just from a tax level, but also from a FI level. And hey, what are my expenses? What can I take out? What kind of free money do I get in terms of standard deductions, et cetera, et cetera? So there's really an important framework here. And I know a lot of people, their minds shut off, unfortunately, when it comes to tax, but I think this makes a lot of sense. And I think I know it's so important that we all really just understand, like, okay, how does this work? And as always, Jonathan, things change, right? I mean, we don't expect no changes between now and 70 years from now. And we're going to keep updating this. And as always in the FI community, we make changes with the rules as they are, and we kind of roll forward. So yeah, I mean, any final words?
That's it. I hope you're encouraged, and I hope you're taking action on this, and I hope it gives you confidence as you start putting together a tax strategy, because it absolutely, absolutely makes a monetary difference in the outcome. All right, my friends, the fire is spreading. We'll see you next time as we continue to go down the road less traveled.